Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Beth Macy. Her book, Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town, recently came out in paperback. She joins us by telephone from Roanoke, Virginia. Welcome back, Beth.
Thanks, Vic. It's great to be back.
Wow, Beth, this book, when we talked last time, it was getting a lot of buzz, and it ended up being one of the big books of the year last year. Now that the smoke has cleared a little bit, what do you think?
Oh, I think it was great. It was a great surprise to me. You know, I wrote it, and a lot of it was not in my normal wheelhouse. I'm not a business writer, and so I worried a lot, and, you know, some sleepless nights about, like, did I get it wrong, and people are going to hate it, or they're going to think it's too much business or too much family or whatever. But, you know, and then, of course, my husband said he liked it, but he has to live with me, so I really didn't know. So it was when it came out and it got good reviews and it sold reasonably well, it was super exciting.
All right. Well, we probably have a few people out there who either haven't read the book or didn't hear your previous interview or both. Tell us how you got the idea for this, what you were doing and what led to the creation of an actual book of this size.
Sure. So I was a longtime reporter for the Roanoke Times, and I did a lot of feature kind of enterprise series about what I would call, I called it my own outsiders and underdogs beat. I wrote a lot about people struggling during the recession years especially, and I've written a lot about refugees and immigrants. And I got interested in looking at this community that's about an hour south of Roanoke where I live, called Henry County. And Martinsville is the county seat there. And it was once, they said it was more millionaires per capita in that community than anywhere in America. I'm not sure if that's exactly true. I kept looking for a better source on that, but it's just one of those recycled things. It was very prosperous during its time, and it was kind of Virginia's manufacturing powerhouse. And one of the lessons I took away is, like, it was very heavily invested in textiles and furniture. And so when those two things went offshore, this was a community hit, like, really, really hard. So it had the highest unemployment rate in the state for 12 years. Things like food insecurity soared, food stamp usage tripled, disability rates went up, I think it's 64% from the time China joined the WTO in 2001 to now. It's gone up 64% in this one community. And I started looking at kind of what is the impact in a community, what happens when half of its jobs go away. They literally lost half of their employment positions in this town. And during the process of doing some pre-interviewing, I was talking to a friend of mine who runs a furniture store. And this was initially for a newspaper series. And he said, well, you know, there's this guy that kept his factory going, and he's in Galax, which is another Southern Virginia community about an hour and a half in the other direction. And the story of how he managed to save his factory was just this great sort of David and Goliath story. And I knew at the moment I first heard it, I mean, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. So here's this guy in a little town called Galax, which is really well known for bluegrass and barbecue. And in 2001, he files what is essentially the world's largest anti-dumping petition against China from Galax, because he believes they are illegally dumping product and they're marking it in order to drive all of our factories out of business, which, of course, they were, and he proved that in a court of international trade. But he was just this larger-than-life character, and once I met him and heard him speak and realized that you could tell kind of the whole history, not just of what's happened in the last 15 years with all the factory closings, but also kind of his family story was really interesting too, because they had sort of, if you will, swiped furniture making after the Civil War at the turn of the last century from higher wage rate states like Michigan and New York, and, you know, chasing abundant lumber and cheap labor. And so you can really tell kind of the whole economic history of the country over the last century through this one guy and his family. And that was really exciting.
And his name is Bassett,
His name is John Bassett III. His grandfather started Bassett Furniture Industries in 1902. And this little community, the one I was just talking about, this suffered these great job losses. And when John was born in 1937, he was thought to have been to be the heir apparent. And you know, and I heard this about him the first time I heard about this whole story, how he had taken China on. I heard that, you know, he had been booted out of this company and this town that he was born to inherit. And this is a town, a truly company town called Bassett, Virginia. It's unincorporated. You know, in the early days, you lived in a company house, you paid your light bill at the company headquarters. I mean, the Bassett Furniture owned the police, the street sweepers, everything. They owned everything in the town but the school, you know, and then like 10 feet out from the school they owned. And I just realized that that his story was so compelling, and just, you know, through his story alone, it was really interesting. So he was booted out in 1982 by an older brother-in-law who wanted the position for himself and wanted to save it for his son. So it also becomes this kind of interesting family feud story, which I think, if you maybe can't come to a hard business story through the business angle alone, I think we can all relate to, like, a large family, you know, not getting along and this very kind of very human desire to be in charge and have power. And so to me, it was a story that people could come at in a variety of ways. And I think that's why, you know, men readers liked it, women readers liked it, Southerners liked it, non-Southerners liked it. I think it had a mass appeal because of there were so many different kinds of stories going on within this one story.
Beth Macy joins us. Her book is Factory Man. It just came out in paperback. Your prodigious reporting and just amazing ability to dig through all these layers and do all these interviews and travel all around. This is really just an astounding bit of work you put into this. How long did it take you, and how many people did you interview, and how did you manage to do it all?
Well, I started in late 2011, initially as a newspaper series, and kind of looking at the aftermath of globalization. And then right after I met John Bassett III in Galax, I thought this might could be the book I've always been waiting to write. I mean, finally I've met someone whose story is so emblematic and of what's going on with globalization and offshoring. And he just happens to be kind of this Faulknerian, feisty, super feisty, kind of hard to deal with person, but also really interesting too. And so I started thinking right away, this could be a book proposal. And then once I wrote a book proposal and got an agent and sold it, then I worked on it for maybe another year, and then it was another kind of year in the hopper after I turned it in, being edited and going through the production. So I guess I worked on it all told about 2 years, but some of that time I was working at my newspaper job full time.
This fellow Bassett, what a character. He was cooperative, wasn't he? He let you interview him. He let you travel around with him.
Yeah. He was cooperative, but he was very careful. I was talking to a friend of mine about him yesterday, and she grew up in the South in kind of a privileged family. And she said, you know, we're taught we don't break the code. And so the code is, like, you don't say anything bad about your relatives. And so even though a lot of the story is about there's this family feud sort of percolating in the background, he's not going to tell me anything like that. He doesn't say anything bad about his competitors, even though he clearly had this epic, huge battle to get this coalition built in order just to file this anti-dumping petition. But he very much goes by the Southern code of being polite and at the same time being just who he is, which is a very bossy, very demanding person. So he controlled a lot of the interviews. And so occasionally I could get him like to talk about something I wanted him to talk about, but usually he was trying to maneuver me, and that was, he was a great character to write about, but it wasn't easy. And, you know, he tried to make it all on his terms. And so I was constantly, there was never like a moment interviewing him that wasn't like filled with a little bit of tension. You know?
Well, he's very stubborn. I mean, that's how he's succeeded in business, right?
Yeah. And he works hard. He works harder than anyone I've ever met. I mean, he's constantly thinking about his business. I mean, he's not, you know, don't get me wrong, he's not in the factory. He's in the factory every day and tweaking things. He's not actually, you know, on the assembly line, not that kind of hard work, but he's thinking about it all the time. And so one of the things he had to do was he had to gather this coalition of half of his industry back in the early aughts in order just to file this dumping petition with the Commerce Department. And a lot of them didn't want to join his coalition because they were already importing. So maybe they were doing, it was called a blended strategy. Maybe they were importing half of the furniture they were selling and they were still making half. Maybe they had closed two of their four factories, for instance. And they realized, oh, we might be closing them all. And if he wins this, we might have to be the ones that pay the duties because we'll be the importer of record, and that's going to hurt our pocketbook. We're not going to make as much profit as we were before. And so he did a lot of begging, bullying, you know, strong-arming people he had been friends with his whole life to join this coalition, but he did it. And then he got all of his mom-and-pop retailers on board, too. And, you know, I think he got 700 different stores in America to sign on. And so he was battling these giant big-box stores, which, you know, by far sold way more furniture than his mom-and-pops did. But just the sheer number of the mom-and-pops getting them on the side, it said a lot at the U.S. International Trade Commission. I mean, it made a big impact. But he called every single one of them.
Beth Macy joins us. Her book is Factory Man. This is such a nuanced story. I was not aware of how we lost the furniture business and how it just, we had this gradual encroachment from places like China and how they figured out how to make this furniture much more cheaply, how it all went away, how we were overconfident. We thought, oh, they're never going to take the bedroom suit business.
Right,
you go into
all big and bulky. Yeah.
Yeah, you go into all the details about this before we get into the strategy of how Bassett fought back. Can you give us a little overview about how we lost the furniture industry?
Sure. Well, the first factory in Bassett, Virginia closed in 1989, but you know, you saw it going on earlier with things like textiles down in Martinsville and Henry County because they were lighter weight and they were easier to import. And then this happened in virtually every company. Like they would start out importing just as a way to stay competitive. First, they would drop their prices to stay competitive with the imports coming in, and then they would start importing themselves partly out of a defensive maneuver. And then before you knew it, like they weren't paying as much attention to their domestic production. They were becoming less competitive. They were not investing in new equipment to keep their operations here locally competitive and earning. And so it became like at some point a tipping point was reached for most of the companies, and they would just gradually one factory closed after another.
Some of this reads like a spy novel because John wanted to know where these unbelievably cheap bedroom suits were coming from. Where in China were they coming from, and what was this place like?
Yeah, there was this one particular suit of furniture that came in the market right around 2000, 2001, and it was wholesaling definitely for less than it cost just to buy the wood to make it. And he knew that because he had his line workers he bought a piece or a suit and had his line workers deconstruct and then price out the parts. Because if you're selling it for less than the parts, that's dumping, and that's supposed to be illegal according to the World Trade Organization rules that they signed on to when they joined. And so he wanted to find out more because he was trying to gather ammo for he was at the time just considering leading this charge to file this petition. And so he, the sticker on the back of this particular dresser said Dalian, China, and that's a region in northern China. Most of the earlier furniture that was being imported was Taiwanese-owned, but it was in southern China in places like Dongguan and, you know, what they consider the China's factory floor. But this was new. It was coming from this newer region, which was only beginning to be really heavily industrialized. And so they were paying even cheaper rates, and the government was heavily subsidizing it. So he went up there, and as he put it, I want to get eyeball to eyeball with the guy running this factory, who was also a Communist Party official. And the man actually said to John Bassett and his son and his family friend slash Taiwanese translator, you must close your factories and put your business entirely in my hands. And he had plans to become the largest bedroom furniture in the world, which, of course, is what Bassett Furniture once was. That rang a bell with him. And so, as I say, kind of early on in the book, for once in his life, John Bassett didn't say anything. He just listened to the guy talk. And then later he said to his son in the car, my grandfather would roll on his over in his grave if I just turn tail and run, as he puts it. So he went back and lawyered up. He got the best, one of the best known trade law firms in the country to represent him, spent a fortune in legal fees. I mean, it wasn't an easy thing. They put a lot of their own personal money on the line, and it was a very personal thing to him. And they filed the suit, and then they won in 2005, and then they won again in 2010 at the Sunset Review hearing. So they basically proved that they were being injured by the imports and that certain factories in China were indeed dumping.
A suit over a suit. My guest is Beth Macy. Her book is Factory Man. You must be watching with a great deal of interest what's going on in China right now. We have reshoring happening in your book. We see where it got too expensive to make furniture in China in a lot of places because of the changes in the economy there and how the furniture making is going to other places like Indonesia. And now with the correction occurring over there in China, you must be observing this with some interest.
Yeah, I've been on deadline with my new book, but I have been trying to keep up with that and also with the debate about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, there was a great article in the Sunday Times last Sunday about zombie factories, which are like dead factories that kind of look like what I witnessed in Bassett and Martinsville. And with their economy struggling now and the government trying to keep these, because, you know, the government does subsidize. That's part of the problem. That's why they're so hard to compete with. So they're trying to, the Chinese government now trying to figure out how to keep people employed over there during this downturn because of, you know, they want to keep their social stability. So it's a really interesting time. At the same time, you have, like, some Chinese companies opening up factories here now. There's some textile plants recently opened in South Carolina that are Chinese-owned, and I think a furniture factory, too.
Amazing how the circle goes round and round. I think some of the most compelling stuff in your book, Factory Man, is the stuff relating to the racial situation over the decades in this little town and just all the peculiarities and pluses and minuses involved in that relationship.
Yeah, it was, you know, I talked about the company being founded in 1902, and there were a lot of sharecroppers, you know, eager to join the cash economy, and that had been a big tobacco plantation area during slavery and then sharecropping. And a lot of those Bassett Furniture was very unusual at the time. 1902, they actually hired African-American workers to work in certain departments. They were segregated departments, and they got kind of the nastiest jobs and working in the rub room and doing the finishing work. But they paid them half of what they paid the white workers. So it was progressive on one side because, like, their competitors in North Carolina were not even employing blacks at all. But on the other hand, you know, they were paying them much less, and that gave them this competitive advantage that did lead to them eventually, helped lead to them becoming the largest furniture manufacturer in the world, which they were in the 60s and 70s, and they were Fortune 500 in the 80s. And so I, you know, this is a book not just about furniture making, but it's also about how we treat our laborer and how we treat and the people who work and help us build our wealth. And so I felt that I had to address that issue, both on in the sense of how African Americans were treated in the factory, as well as a lot of people that worked in the homes of the families that ran this town.
Yeah, the woman who was forced to wear two girdles.
Yep, two girdles at once. Yeah. I was interviewing somebody for my new book, which is set kind of near Bassett and Henry County. It's the next county over. And she had been a domestic worker. And she hadn't read my book. And I didn't want to, like, ask the question in a way that I would give away the answer. But I said she had been a domestic worker in Martinsville, and she had also been a furniture factory worker. And I said, Janet, do you know what I mean when I use the phrase two girdles at once? Because she had just said she had been a maid. And she said, two, three, if you could get them on.
Oh, man.
And this was just like, I was like, this is a thing. This is a phrase.
Wow.
And, you know, it was to keep them from being groped or outright raped.
Hmm.
And just, you know, I'll never forget some of the interviews I had were African-American ladies in their 80s are demonstrating the way they would serve the meal around the family table and know that a hand was going to go up their leg. And it was still a hard thing for people to talk about. But I think when somebody wants to tell you that story, you have a obligation to show the reality of what people have gone through.
Well, clearly,
families, basically,
you were able to establish trust with a lot of these people, and a lot of them aren't around to be interviewed anymore. You were just there in time to talk to some of these elderly observers and witnesses.
Yeah.
Who experienced.
You're right. The woman I was just talking about, who was talking about serving the dinner, she did. She just passed away a month ago. I was talking to her daughter this week. Her daughter happens to be the head of the NAACP, and she's a character in Factory Man, too, and was calling me about something else, but it was great to catch up.
Well, you've got it all here. You've got the rivalries. You've got the dirt. The rivalry between JB3 and his brother-in-law is pretty intense. You talk about how it supposedly culminated in a fist fight and Spillman's drunken antagonism towards his pilot. There's a lot of juicy stuff in here.
John Bassett calls it a cross between Gone with the Wind and Peyton Place. He gives me no credit for all the business stuff I had to learn and the history of the industry.
Well, Beth, I think we better tell people about your roots here in this area. I don't want to leave that out. You're from Champaign County.
I'm from Urbana, Ohio, and my mom worked at a factory there off and on as I was growing up. She worked at Grimes Manufacturing, soldering airplane lights when the economy was good. And when it wasn't, she would get laid off and sort of have to pick up under the table work, babysitting and waitressing, just like a lot of the people that I write about in the book. And so I dedicate the book to her and to all the world's factory workers because, you know, just in honor of their work ethic and, you know, just how hard they had it.
Tell us about this book you're working on.
Sure. This is another book that is grown out of a newspaper series. When I first came to Roanoke in 1989, I was but a child, and riding around with a photographer one day, he said, well, if you want to know the best story in town, you're not going to be able to get it because nobody's been able to get it. And then he proceeds to tell me about these two African-American young brothers who were kidnapped around the turn of the last century and sold to the circus. they were albino African Americans, and they were basically exhibited in sideshows. And they became quite famous, especially once they got with Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey, at a time when, you know, we didn't have the internet, and a poor maid working in Roanoke, Virginia, couldn't find out what had happened to her son. So the hero of this book is really their mother, Harriet Muse, and it's about her efforts to win their freedom back and in the Jim Crow South. And it's called True Vine, which is a little sharecropping community they all came from, and named for a time when, from a verse from the Bible, and for a time when the best hope a lot of African Americans had was for the afterlife. And it's really about power and race and themes that are very much still with us today, unfortunately. And but it's kind of a really great historical yarn too. And I learned so much about not just the circus, which was interesting, but also a lot about segregation era life in Virginia, and some of the very same threads that I pulled for Factory Man, I'm pulling again here, and it's still new, and sometimes it's still shocking, the things I heard, and but it's similar story in some ways.
Are you just now putting together your first draft?
I've actually turned it in, and I got it back, and I worked on the edits, and I just turned the revisions in. So it's supposed to come out next September, and I'm just getting ready to gather all my photographs. Their stage names were Eco and Ico, Ambassadors from Mars. Their real names were George and William Muse, and it's amazing there are still some people out there who remember seeing them when they were young. And I've kind of been doing the same thing, interviewing a lot of older people. Missed a lot of people, unfortunately, and not a lot of people left that worked with them. But Willie Muse ended up living to be 108 and died in 2001. And I had a hard time getting the story initially because his caregiver, who was his great niece, didn't want to exploit him anymore. It's hard to write about sideshow people without kind of re-exploiting them again. And she was wanted them to have a really nice life in retirement. And so I never got to interview him. And it's taken me 25 years really to get her to trust me enough to let me tell their story. But she still doesn't trust me on the way. In some ways, she's very not unlike John Bassett in some ways. She's a very interesting person and very dear, but she's very, very tough. And once you see how the press treated her family during this, I mean, there are lawsuits, and the mother was, police were brought out when the mother claimed them, and Ringling said, no, they're ours, they're not yours, and there was this big brouhaha. Once you see the way the family was treated in the press, you understand why she's not going to let just anybody tell the story, and why the trust there is still a big issue.
Beth, we'll watch for that in a year. We really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you, Vic. I really enjoyed it.
My guest has been Beth Macy. Her book, Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshore and Stayed Local and Helped Save an American Town, just out in paperback for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.